Welcome to the Manor.
Welcome back to the Twin Terrors Macabre Manor of Mead, Metal, and Mayhem. I'm Jody.
And I'm James. Woo!
You sure about that?
Yes, I'm James Woo.
Okay.
People look at me and go, well, surely you're of Asian descent.
No, they don't.
You're the whitest boy we've ever seen. Wow, the next thing I was going to say, it's not racist. It was just going to be horrible. I was going to say, the only thing you have in common with Japanese culture is that they allied with the Germans, and you look like you were a member of the Hitler Youth Brigade when you were 14.
Yes, you did. No.
Anyway, moving on from that, while everything is still, saying everything's still kosher after just referencing Hitler is probably not cool.
That's what you get.
Anyway.
Ah.
Well, look, I'm looking at my notes for the next bit, and I see something you mentioned last episode.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, what are we talking about this time?
I'm assuming it's more 50th anniversary D&D stuff.
I'm hoping, because that's what I got in front of me.
Okay. I shot my wad last episode.
Does anybody have a towel or moist towelette?
As of right now, I don't have any more notes.
Well, I'm sure you can jump in here.
I'll try. And
I guess I'll bring up things that might or might not be pertinent. And we'll see how far we get, because my next notes for D&D, again, is a run-up to actual TSR and Arneson and Gygax and all the things. And yeah. I've got some notes on a couple of different, like, man, I got some other notes. But you, my good gentleman, said you had a different beer than the one you were drinking in the previous episode.
I do. I was going to say, well, I can still say it because I just entered this in the app that shall not be named. And apparently I had tried it before, but I think this is the first time I'm actually having a full can of it. So I was going to say, and still will, because it is kind of new to me. New year, new beer. Straight to ale from here in Huntsville, Alabama. Black Sheep. It is a pastry stout with vanilla and maple syrup.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds amazing.
And I almost had to fight my wife just to get a can because she bought a 4-pack and was like, I don't know if I'm going to let you have any.
Well, marriage is all about shared.
Yeah, she was nice and said I could have one, but I have to get her something that she thinks is of equal value because she really likes this one.
Aren't you going to go up and give her that later anyway? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
I'm not discussing such things on the podcast.
Well, and she said equal value, and we all know that's worth like 2 4-packs right there.
Oh, there you go.
Cool. Well, that's how it really. So, I mean, it must be good.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The episode we just recorded. If people want to do the matching thing, for those of you who do that, I had, and the one we just recorded was Dragon's Milk Oatmeal Cookie.
Yeah,
which is good. And now I'm having the last of my Dragon's Milk Mocha Mint.
Interesting.
It's really good if you like mocha mint. And I do, but it has to be in the right proportions. And this one's a little off to me, the couple I've had, but maybe this one will be better. I don't know. We'll see. It's still good.
Okay.
It's just out of all the dragon's milk, I kind of prefer the regular or the oatmeal cookie, or I mean, the s'more. Oh, the s'mores, I tell you. Oh,
Ooh,
love,
s'mores.
love the s'more. Love the cherry chocolate. What was the one I really super loved? Go, I'm scrolling through because I'm about to put this in the app that shall not be named, and I'm remember. Ooh, the Stroop waffle.
Oh, I've got some Stroopwafel in the other room.
Well, that Stroop waffle beer was amazing.
Nice, nice.
But anyway, yes. So, in the previous episode, I was talking about being at the bar, and one of the other guys there who comes in pretty regular, he's kind of exactly my age. Like, we're 6 months apart, and we talk about Gen X things, and he's into the MR James, and he does video games and science and stuff. So we talk about a lot of stuff. And I had two of the smaller beers there, like 4%. That was it, because I knew I was gonna have a couple drinks as we recorded. And I said, yeah, I'm gonna have some small ones here and probably some Guinness later to keep myself kind of low. And well, now I'm on number two of 11% beers. So John, I don't actually think you listen to the episodes, but if you do, I'm okay right now. Okay, so dice.
Dice?
Dice.
I
I thought I
remember
would
him.
give a quick overview of how dice, I almost said geese came into daming, which is better than lice going into daming.
Yeah.
But just a little thing of a. Well, here we go. Got a couple things. We'll see how far we get in this episode, but for those of us who grew up, I'm gonna jump in and kiss myself. Ha! Love the one you're with, and I'm by myself.
That's okay. Moving on.
That's a drink.
Yay.
Now, for those of us who grew up with Dungeons and Dragons, it is easy to take the polyhedral dice of gaming for granted. And oh, hey, here we go. I actually have some notes that will overlap with Jody's things earlier.
Cool.
Dice had played an integral role in gaming since Russian war gamers of the early 19th century.
Ah, okay.
So go back and listen to that. And modern hobby wargaming culture began in the 1950s, and it pretty much stuck with six-siders and the first Avalon Hill game called Tactics from 1954 that Jody mentioned in the previous episode. Right? Did you mention Tactics?
I did, yes.
Okay. I think you mentioned the actual designer. The publisher was Avalon Games.
Yeah, I meant to mention Avalon Games and forgot.
Well, here we go.
All right.
That's why there's two of us.
Yeah.
Well, but actually, if it's just one of us, we could just read off a script and we wouldn't forget anything.
That's a fair point.
but anyway, it required a qubit for combat resolution, and the miniature gamers who contributed to the War Game Digest similarly seemed content to rely on the D6 and just realized D6. When Jody and I will say D6, D10, D20, that just means the dice of six sides or 10 sides or 20 sides.
Yeah, the polyhedral dice.
Yeah, and I've got a note about what that means here in a second.
Ah, cool.
But by 1970, the polyhedral dice, but I'll give a definition here soon, had begun to creep into the wargaming community, as we see in the advertisement from a 1971 Wargamers newsletter. But why do we need these funny dice anyway?
Yeah.
That was the name of the advertisement.
Okay.
And wargamers constantly reach for greater heights of realism in their simulations. So by the
That's
mid-1960s, they increasingly relied on actual military statistics, woo, statistics, to model their combat. Perhaps the most influential example of this trend is Michael J. Korns, with a K, if you want to look it up. Korn's book, Modern Warfare, or sorry, Modern War in Miniature from 1966, a World War II setting war game which offers little by way of system other than tables aggregating real world weapon behavior. Ooh. Yes. And this is where some people will be like, oh my God, what you do is so boring. And to be fair, I love statistics, so I'd be okay with this. I can see that being a little dry for even gamers. But yeah, Korn's reduce those statistics to percentile probabilities. For example, a particular rifle might have a 70% chance to hit a target 200 yards away. How would you resolve those odds? How would you
That was
resolve those
easy for
odds
you to
during
say.
play? There is no intuitive way to extract percentile results from rolling a small number of d6s. The Korns provided an appendix that gave the closest approximations in roughly 5% increments.
Yeah, okay. So a 20-sided die or a d20.
Yeah. Or icosahedron.
What you said, yeah.
And Korn's game proved very influential in the American Midwest, took hold in two communities where Dungeons and Dragons would really grow up, which was Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and the Twin Cities of Minnesota.
Yeah.
For example, Mike Carr, who we'll talk about really soon, who's a prominent Twin Cities gamer, incorporated the above table into his 1972 edition of his Fight in the Skies. In Lake Geneva circles, Leon Tucker, himself a professional statistician, so I doff my cap as a fellow professional stats dude,
Cool.
advocated strongly for the use of Korn's as rules, but was dissatisfied with the means of resolving percentile probability and the need for greater realism, demanded more than just approximation, 5% increments, which led to an outpouring of creativity. As gamers developed all sorts of improvisational ways of getting percentile numbers. For example, you could draw two cards from a deck with the face cards removed, you know, so ace through 10, you know.
Yeah.
Or pick numbered poker chips out of a hat.
Okay.
Tucker himself proposed an elaborate apparatus, not an elaboratus.
I was hearing rabbit in there somewhere too.
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my ass.
That trick never works.
Damn, I almost spit my beer. I have pictures of my grandparents on the wall behind where I record. They almost were introduced to some mocha mint dragon's milk. It's because the rabbit likes it up. Anyway. Tucker himself proposed an elaborate apparatus involving a graduated tube with a stopper and colored beads as part of his ongoing, speaking of things going up your ass, as part of his ongoing collaboration with Gary Gygax and Mike Reese towards a new post-Korns set of modern miniature rules called Tractics.
Okay.
So in late 1969, with the commercial availability of 20-sided dice, finally, these implements were presented as a means of generating percentile numbers. And percentage dice, and doesn't really even say how many they had at the time, but this is an area where the exotic, it's an area where the exotic icosahedron excels. And I'm stuttering because now all I can think of is flat world, which is a mathematics thing where the more number of sides and angles you have, the more higher up you are. And women, of course, want to marry men of higher sides. And that's where the exotic things throw me off because now I'm picturing geometric shapes doing naughty things to each other and I need to stop drinking. Anyway, this is at a time where models sold 10-sided dice numbered 0 through 9, and they would roll them twice rather than 1 through 20 with two throws to generate a number from 1 to 100.
Okay.
Gary Gygax was among the readers of Wargamer's newsletter at the time, and thus it was unsurprising that he chimed in with the letter in February 1971, saying, "I imagine the sales of 20-sided dice will pick up when Mike Rees starts selling the Tractics rules."
Yeah.
That's probably
Okay.
not what he said, but anyway. And the D20 gets an early mention in the Tractics rules published in the fall of 1971.
Oh, you know what else came out in 1971?
My dad's semen because I was born in 72.
Not where I was going with that.
Going to mute because I'm going to die. You go ahead and tell me.
Chainmail. So that's probably getting ahead of where we're at. So,
Well, I'm going to get up to like 73-ish here, but it's because it's dice specific. But then we're going to jump back.
yeah.
And we'll get the chain mail soon. Anyway, news
By the
of
way,
the
that was brilliant.
Thanks. News of an American supplier of 20-sided dice began to spread in mid-1972 through Wargaming Zines, Creative Publications of California. That company only sold their 20-sided dice in a set with four other dice, one of each platonic solid.
Okay.
Yeah, these five geometric shapes alone have a special property that all their faces, edges, and vertices have the same relationship to their center of gravity, which makes them ideal as dice.
Okay.
And it has to do with the angles all being equal and everything with each of the sides having the same angles and shapes for each side, which is why it's different than the D10. Because if you look at a D10, you'll see that the sides are not all like each face of a dice, of a die in the Platonic solid, all have the same, the sides have the same length and the angles are all the same measurement. If you look at the
Yeah.
D10, you look at a face, you'll see that it's two sides are longer than the third. So,
There's four sides to a face.
well, on a six, sure. What about a D4? Only three sides.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the D10 and it's got.
Oh, is the D10 have four? But they're not all equal, right? I don't know why I was thinking three. I don't have my dice in front of me. So they have four.
Yes.
But they're not equal, right?
No, two are longer than the other two.
Okay,
Two
so
are long and two are short. So, yeah.
just like my testicles.
Okay.
Moving on before Charles Xavier hears about this and recruits me as his first mutant to have
Now I'm thinking of Cheech and Chong
no.
from Still Smoking.
Yeah.
E.T., Eddie Torres, the extra testicle. Anyway.
Anyway, this makes them ideal for dice. Both the six-sider and 20-sider, rounded out with the D4, D8, D12 are Platonic solids, and all these shapes have origins that go back. Well, it says, okay, I don't know why I wrote this. I was making these notes where I took this from, and I can take all these because we don't get paid, and this is an educational podcast. As crude as it may be, says they go back into prehistory, but they really don't. It goes back to Grecian times, hence Plato and Platonic solids.
I was gonna say, because I know that we've seen the memes on Facebook about 20-sided dice from ancient Egypt.
No, they, yeah, Egypt had them.
But
The, yeah, dice have been around for a long time, and then people have seen the gaming with many-sided dice well before Grecian times.
But that's not prehistory. That's history.
Is Egypt has a history that we know of.
Exactly, yeah.
Who are these strange people that we don't know of who build pyramids? Oh, wait, I've got an answer for you. Are you ready? Aliens.
Yeah.
Anyway, to move on,
Yeah.
Don Lowry is a name that will come up soon, but he began to stock these as a service to Tractix customers, initially without even a markup because he could sell other systems with it. And a person known as Gary Gygax frequently helped Lowry to promote new products in his mailer, Lowry's Guidon. And with the arrival of the polyhedral dice came Gygax's seminal June 1973 article, 4 and 20 and What Lies Between, where Gygax confides in the same article that he was busy working up chance tables for a fantasy campaign game. Yeah, look at the gams on that dragon. But that game, of course, was Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes, it was.
And I have one section before I get into pre-TSR where we actually have people that people will know about.
People that people will know
That's what I said. I don't know what the hell I meant, but
about. People that people.
that next section before we get into pre-TSR times with the people who will create TSR, and we'll get into what that means then, is a gentleman named Jack Vance.
I know that name.
I would imagine you do because you know things.
Not always useful things, but I know things.
That's That sounds like me at work. So, depending on when we get there, we may talk about Vecna. If you've watched Stranger Things, you'll know who Vecna is more or less.
Yeah.
But I wrote, did you know that Vecna, he the disembodied hand and eyeball, is a deliberate anagram of Vance?
I did know that, but it's not something that I keep in my memory.
Yeah, it's like I did know that,
It's something I frequently forget. But yes, I did know that because we'll talk about that later.
yeah, and a little bit here, but we'll get into more later. I put it here because it just seemed like a little thing to be odd to get into later, and this way it's done. But yeah, you're right. We'll talk more about it soon. But Gary Gygax made no secret of his love for the work and person of Jack Vance, and the Dying Earth stories in particular were often cited by Gygax as a major influence on the genesis of Dungeons and Dragons. Most prominently, of course, in what came to be known as Vancian Magic System.
Yes.
I can keep reading, but if you want to go into it.
I've read up on it. I don't remember the details, but I have read up on it had a major influence on the magic system in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. For those of you who are like, the right magic users, then they get to cast a spell once and then they have to rest.
Yeah.
Which is a thing, and we'll probably get into that. But that's in D&D. Mages wake up, whatever level you are, tells you how many spells you can have per day. You study them at the beginning of the day. Once you cast it, it's gone out of your memory, and you have to sleep and memorize it again when you wake up.
Right.
And Vancian magic is more specifically the magic of the Dying Earth series of stories, because few can master more than a handful of spells at a time, because the words themselves are pretty much a living force that have to be mentally grappled with and overcome and forced into the magic user's brain, where it seethes with barely restrained potential. And then once it's uttered, nearly all these spells are what D&D fans would term a verbal component, where you speak it out loud. It is purged utterly from the mind, absolutely wiped clean, until the wizard once again consults his magic user's book or his tome.
Yeah.
And I've got a little quote here from a Dying Earth series to give you an idea. And for those of you who play D&D, this will sound, I mean, the spell names aren't the same, but you'll pick up the basic gist of them being very similar, where
Right.
Mezurian the magician. Mezurian made a selection from his books and with great effort forced five spells upon his brain: Vandal's Gyrator, Felagund's Secret Hypnotic Spell, the excellent Prismatic Spray, The chain of untiring nourishment and the spell of omnipotent sphere.
Prismatic sphere? Did I hear prismatic sphere?
You did hear prismatic sphere, but it was the excellent prismatic sphere.
Oh, as opposed to the regular prismatic sphere that I'm used to.
Right. This one was taught to him by two young magic users named Bill and Ted. And that's, yeah. My next note should have gone to Wargamings, where we talk about the Siege of Bodenburg, but I'm not going to stress because I put that in the wrong spot.
Oh, okay.
We could, but you want to keep going a little bit, do a little pre-TSR?
Sure. Yeah. I'm
We'll see
drinking
how
beer.
far we get.
I'm on my second beer of the night. I'm feeling pretty good. We can do whatever you want. Wait, let me rephrase that. We can do whatever you want in relation to this D&D podcast episode.
Well, considering we are a couple hundred miles away from each other, you're pretty safe on most things. But that does sound like my dating life when I was younger. Right. So pre-TSR, we have mentioned Avalon Hill.
Yes, we have.
But the thing about them was that they released only one game a year. So a young man named Gary Gygax suggested creating a war game inventors guild. So, 1967, he co-founded the International Federation of Wargamers, the IGW. Because they wanted to have people make more rules and games.
That sounds like that sounds like the IBEW, like an official union or something, you know?
IFW Local 516.
Yeah.
And I do realize I said IGW because that's what I wrote. But then the next sentence down was Guy Staff Enterprises, which Gary created as he started dabbling in creating and marketing games to help raise money for the IFW. I'm like, wait, IF? IG? Well, International Federation would be IFW. Yes, the Automotive Steel Workers Union of.
Oh, man.
In 1967, also, Gary invited a bunch of friends over to his house to game for the weekend, and it was so much fun. They decided to do a convention the following year, hence the first Gen Con in 1968, which matches up with what we talked about last episode.
Yeah.
Could be August 4th, 1968.
Yeah.
So we mentioned Gary Gygax. Everybody knows he is one of the co-founders of Dungeons and Dragons, and the other is a gentleman named Dave Arneson.
Yes, not Aronson, as I
No.
have incorrectly pronounced it several times in my life.
And I can see why. Even sober.
Yes.
So Gary Gygax met Dave Arneson, and here's the fun part. In either 1968 or 1969, because out of all the books I read, I saw both and would lean towards 1969 from what I read. But
Okay.
according to the story, Gary was in a bookstore, noticed another person had a bunch of books, and what have you got there? Asked Gary. Oh, shit. Hold on a second. Am I talking about the wrong person?
You might be. We have been drinking.
Yep, I'm talking about the wrong person. Or there's another story of the same thing, and I decided to just do this one. Damn you, dragon's milk. So, Sue, I'm just going to go with what I wrote.
Okay.
What have you got there? Asked Gary. Oh, these are models I've been working on. They're 1 to 1200 scale ship of the line models, said a dark haired, fresh faced man sporting thick glasses and a mustache, and I'm pretty sure I took this right out of one of the books.
Yeah.
Neat. What do you
Sounds
play?
like it.
Asked Gary. Well, we use Fletcher Pratt naval rules. I play with my group in the Twin Cities. I'm Dave. Dave Arneson. Gary Gygax. Nice to meet you. Yeah, but Arneson showed him the rules for Don't Give Up the Ship, the name of the wargaming thing.
Yeah.
And Gary wanted to help refine the rules. It was the same as with another young man named Jeff Perrin, where Perrin had a set of rules called Chainmail, and Gary helped refine those, showing his collaboration skills.
Okay.
But for Don't Give Up the Ship, this is where they brought in another person named Mike Carr that we'll talk about more soon to help edit it, who was a part of Arneson's Twin Cities Gaming Group. I mean, this is where you either go into way too much detail or you kind of skim it to let people know how people met and what they're doing, and we kind of move on. I didn't want to make each episode 20 hours.
No, and that would have been very easy to do.
Yeah. And
Wow,
at
I can't
this,
talk.
just as a note, at this time, Gary was working at a fireman's insurance in Chicago. He was, I said I wouldn't go much in biography. He and his wife got married. They lived in Chicago for a bit, then moved out back to Lake Geneva for family things. And he would go in and out to Chicago for his job. But it was Gary's abilities with math and probability for more gaming. He was promoted at his insurance job into, this is the name of the department, the Accidental Death and Dismemberment, or AD&D.
That's brilliant.
Sadly, he lost his job there in 1970, and this is one of those biography things I won't get into, other than to mention that he says it was office politics. Other people say it was because he was making a shit ton of copies for his gaming stuff at the business.
I don't know what that's like.
In that same year, 1970, he, along with these people, Don Kay, Mike Reese, and Leon Tucker, created the military miniature society called Lake Geneva Tactical Studies Association,
Yeah.
which you can hear a fair bit of TSR's full name that we'll get into sometime soonish within that.
Yes, you can.
And in 1970, also with Robert Kuntz, who was a friend of his in Lake Geneva, they created the Castle and Crusade Society.
Oh. Can I do a little aside here?
Absolutely.
Okay, so some foreshadowing.
Dun dun dun.
After Gary Gygax was no longer part of TSR, and actually near the end of his life, he was involved in publishing a role-playing game called, I believe it's called Castle and Crusades. I'd have to look it up. It's on a, I've got some PDFs from it on a thumb drive. So apparently he was referencing back to this earlier thing.
I read quite a bit of what he did after TSR, but I can't remember offhand most of the names other than like Castle Zigzag, Zigyag, or whatever it is, like some sort of.
Yeah, that the castle Zagag, which is it's a Z instead of an X, but in American English, a lot of times we pronounce X in a name as Z. Or well, maybe in British English, I don't know. Anyway, spelled backwards, Gygax would be pronounced Zagag. And that's where that came from.
Which, as I was reading all these, pretty sure that's where the power of Gax came from too, was some of these things that he created between Greyhawk and what you're just talking about. But I mentioned
Yes.
that I played in the Gen Con episode.
Yeah, he would play around with names. He would take the player's name, whether it was his own name or like the first name of one of his kids, because his kids played in some of his early D&D stuff, or some of the other players that were involved in it. And it wasn't just him, it was some of those other people. They would name their characters that way. Like whether it was the spelling of their own name backwards or an anagram or, with letters missing or what have you.
Oh, I've got some things about his kids and their character names.
Yeah, because his some of his kids' character names are they carry through to today in the game.
Yep. In fact, coming up soon, actually, my next, this section will be too long. We'll have to finish it another time. But then the next section are the first characters played in D&D for me.
Cool.
Because this section is called pre-TSR, and
Right.
Dungeons and Dragons is going to start getting set up before TSR's form.
Yeah.
But before the official published rules that came out in 74. I'm going to do the next section if you think we can fit it
Okay, yeah.
in.
Might have to squeeze.
That's what she said. In 1979, and Jody referenced this in the other episode, and I mentioned it once or twice in passing. There was a set of rules created called Chainmail. Rules for Medieval Miniatures by Gary Gygax and Jeff Perrin, who is a fellow LGTSA member.
Yeah.
Had rules on mass combat, man-to-man combat, jousting, and here's the important part, towards the end had a fantasy supplement with magic swords and spells and monsters, and it actually said, refight the epic struggles related by J.R.R. Tolkien, Robert E. Howard, and other fantasy authors, or you can devise your own world.
Yeah.
That's going to be super important.
Yes.
This was published by Don Lowry of Gwydion Games, who kind of mentioned in the dice bit, out of Evansville, Indiana.
Oh, I know where that is.
Me too.
I've been through there.
I have
I've
too.
stopped there a time or two.
I've stopped at a couple brew pubs there.
Yeah, I have too.
Yeah, but it's kind of nice, though. It sounds dumb because, we don't get a lot of stuff in Indiana. So anything we have, like, we have a huge part in making Dungeons and Dragons. Chainmail was significant, not only for the fantasy part, but because it gave rules for man-to-man combat rather than just mass units of armies.
Yeah.
Now, the cover art was by Don Lowry, who pretty much swiped it from Jack Coggan's art, The Fighting Man from 1966, where there's a mounted crusader fighting Turks, and was not the first art swipe by the group and would not be the last.
Yeah, probably not.
And this is where they were still doing miniature wargaming. And of
We've talked
course,
about
when you
that.
start putting in these fantasy elements, they have to come up with things like this. And this is where they would start using kids' toys for miniatures, such as dinosaurs for dragons.
Yes, which is where some of the monsters for Dungeons and Dragons came from. Because Gygax would buy the cheap, like a pack of cheap toys that were manufactured in China, and you would have something that looked like a cross between an owl and a bear. And therefore, you get Owl Bear.
Bear. Which I love because the first initial drawings of those things looked a lot like the little toys, but then as additions went on and artists started to actually make them more realistic, and it's neat to see how they evolved.
Yeah.
Oh, and keep going unless you had more on that.
No. Go ahead.
Including the swipe of the mounted warrior going after a fire-breathing. Including the swipe of the mounted warrior. There's also on the fantasy supplement cover page, there's a warrior going after a fire-breathing dragon that was stolen by Don Lowry from Pauline Baynes's 1949 Farmer Giles of Ham by J.R.R. Tolkien.
This will not be the last time they steal from Tolkien.
Won't be, which kills me because Gygax kind of talks about later how much he doesn't like Lord of the Rings.
And yet.
And yet he used it a lot. I used it so much at one point in time he had to stop using certain aspects.
Yes.
We'll get there. It's kind of soonish. But
I
D&D
might
is
have
not the
something
first.
on that.
Oh, good. Well, me too, but yeah, good. D&D was not the first collaboration between Gygax and Arneson, because they've worked on the 19th century ship battles called Don't Give Up the Ship, which mentioned.
Yep.
And with Don't Give Up the Ship, which they sold through Lowry with Gwydion Games, they also sold some of Arneson's miniature scale ships.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Lowry sold these ships at the suggestion of Gary. So nice to see Gary making sure Dave gets some stuff sold. And they
At least for the
use,
time being.
yeah, I'm trying to give credit while I can.
Somebody should.
Moving on for now.
Soon.
Since I was talking about the Hitler Youth Brigade in the last episode, no, not really for me, but whatever. But anyway, they used the chainmail rules in the imaginary Great Kingdom. That's what they called it, the Great Kingdom, where Arneson was a baron in the Northern Marches, showing that they had started world building together at this time, as well as creating the rules.
Cool.
Gygax and Arneson's collaborations before D&D, they discussed splitting profits 50-50 and went to royalties. But at the time, nobody expected to make more than a couple $100 off a game, because that's kind of what these games would bring in.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about contracts later. Our artisan didn't always get the money. But Mike Carr, who was the third author on Don't Sink the Ship, also had some royalty problems. Did want to mention that Don't Sink the Ship had things called AC for armor class and HP for hit points for the ships.
Cool.
Which is funny, because still might be the first use of the armor class that people talked about. But some of the books I read were, this is the first reference to hit points, which is evidently bullshit, because Jody in the previous D&D episode mentioned German or Prussian or somebody who used hit points.
Yeah, I don't think they called him that at the time, but the concept was the same.
Whatever they called it, like, super similar to that though.
I'm not sure. The Wikipedia article called it hit points. I'm not sure what they called it in the actual. I think it was a
Oh, there we
Kriegspiel.
go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Units in the game could suffer partial losses before being defeated, which were tracked on a sheet of paper, where recreational gamers might call this hit point tracking. So they didn't call it hit points, the same thing. Okay, so maybe it's first term of hit points too.
Yeah, it's pro yeah, I would say probably the first use of the term, yeah. But the concept was already there.
Yes. I'm trying to figure out where we should stop this one. Maybe just a bit more. Gary published Chainmail 1971, received some money that went with his cobbler's activities, because after he got let go at the insurance place, he became a cobbler and helped shoe, like, make shoes, fix shoes in his basement.
Yeah. Cobble, cobble, cobble.
Is that the Hamburglar, but the shoe burglar?
Yeah.
He received some money from chainmail that helped his family to add money to the cobbler's things, and it was nice, but wasn't all that much, because they didn't bring in much money. And because war games were not as popular at the time as board games, such as Monopoly. And do you remember what board game we talked about that was popular and only, like, even outranked most of the others when it came out?
Sorry.
Are you guessing the name of the game, or are you apologizing for not remembering
Yes.
the Ouija board?
Yeah. Which apparently there's a Ouija for Christians now. You can talk directly to Jesus.
Talk directly to Jesus.
I still have to get that. It's on Amazon, apparently.
Look, if you believe in that, you want to talk to Jesus. Pretty sure that's why you go to church. I'm pretty sure there's a whole Reformation about just being able to talk to Jesus directly without the intercession of a priest.
I seem to remember something about that, but
But anyway, I took my drink for referencing Ouija previous episode. I can let you go on about Jesus boards if you want.
No. I'm good and I'm out of beer actually. I downed this black sheep pretty quick.
So
Anyway.
anyway, this goes along with Avalon Hill because it was one of the very few companies that managed to make enough money on war games to do well. And depending on which one of the references I read, it was like one of two really that was big enough to actually be a full-time wargaming company.
Okay.
And I'll say the story of Avalon Hill and the game tactics is interesting, but we're here for D&D, so I'm going to move on.
Okay.
But I will say that although they did well, there's some foreshadowing here.
Ruh-roh, Raggy.
Foreshadowing, drink. Avalon Hill had to sell some of their company to their printer because the printer had enough business acumen to make it more successful and lasting. And there will be, if we get there, when we get there, won't be this first round of D&D, but sometime. Yeah,
Yeah.
they had some issues with that.
Something tells me we'll get at least that far.
Let's hope, even if it's next year.
Yeah.
But I'm okay if it's this year. I don't care.
Yeah. Me either.
We've got to make those notes, but sure.
Yep.
And just want to mention, Gary initially made rules for games, not actual games, hence Tactical Studies Rules, or TSR, which is going to end up being the name of the company they use. And when Chainmail came out with the fantasy piece, many war gamers scoffed because they felt like the game wasn't being taken seriously, but then it started to sell quite well for a group of people that war games didn't really appeal to, such as fans of Tolkien and Robert Howard.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yep. And I'm going to mention just a couple more things, and we'll decide if we want to keep going or not.
Okay.
1972, Arneson started working on miniatures for Chainmail.
Cool.
But don't forget, at this time, Don't Give Up the Ship was their biggest collaboration. And at this time, Gygax had started receiving royalties from Don Lowry at Gwydon. But Arneson and Mykar did not at first.
Ah.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Arneson did eventually receive royalties a few months later. The check bounced and threatened not to do anything else until Lowry ended up paying him.
Don't blame him there.
I don't either. I did my job. Give me my money, fucker.
Yeah, no shit.
And that might be a good place to stop because I do still have. I mean, now we're going to really start getting into the background of D&D. My next notes are on Greyhawk and Blackmoor and the first characters of D&D as they're starting to play test this with friends and family.
Okay.
Then eventually we get to 1973 and then 1974, which is the 50th. And
Yeah.
just so everybody knows, I am now halfway through page 10 of, would you like to guess how many pages of notes I have?
100.
That's a good percentile guess.
Yeah.
But no, 32.
Oh. Okay.
You sound disappointed.
Maybe a little.
Well, shit, it took two episodes to get through 10 pages. I've got 20 some more. That's another 4 to 5 episodes.
Okay.
So we got lots of D&D coming up.
Woohoo!
Next section, I'm going to start going into how they used Chainmail to start creating their worlds and how they started collaborating a bit more and yeah. So maybe this is a good stopping point for this episode. Then I'm going to ask Jody if he wants to do one more or not when we're done here.
Okay.
But until then, I am getting tanked off of Dragon's Milk James.
I am shit-faced on Black Sheep Jody.
You're sheep-faced.
I'm sheep-faced. There you go. I can't wait till my wife comes home.
Anyway, yep, already went out, already did that. So we'll talk to y'all later.
Bye.
The Macabre Manor is brought to you by the Twin Terrors. All rights reserved. Stay tuned for some fun outtakes.
I went ahead and finished off my dragon's milk so I could open up another beer.
Oh, baby, roll a nine, roll a nine. Or as Monica Geller would say, seven, seven. People are strange when you're a people. That's what Black Phillip likes to hear.
Yeah. The picture on the front does make me think of Black Phillip.
You've been a bad boy. That's what the Otyug say to the owlbear when he... Sorry. Roper, I don't even know her.
Boo!
If you've listened to every episode, you'll get the comment.
Yeah, you should know that joke.
We also have to know that there's a creature called the Roper.
That helps, yeah.
And I'm not talking about Three's Company.
Yeah. I'm gonna tell her I'm sheep faced and I can hear the eye roll already.
Almost spit my beer again, damn it.